I'm JD.
And I'm Fraser. Welcome to episode 6 of the 150 Marchers.
Homosexual behaviour between adult consenting males in private should no longer be a criminal offence.
This march was the catalyst for all the rights we've got now.
Why don't we know who they are?
In the vote on gay marriage. Gay marriage.
The eyes have it. The eyes have it.
Children need to be taught.
Charlie Craig's with us today.
Children need to be taught.
Our interview with Peter Tatchell.
Children need to be taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay.
Blackout UK.
Liam Hackett.
Phil Samba from Prepster. The brave step back then.
And we want to make sure that people know their names. Know their names. Know their names.
How you doing today, Fraser?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks. I'm getting back into the swing of things after New Year. Just got back a week-long trip to Antigua.
Oh, nice, nice. You're looking a bit bronzed.
Thank you.
I am really cold as I just got back from Italy.
Oh, wow. How was Italy?
Amazing. Did the Call Me By Your Name trip.
Lovely.
The same as your Antigua trip. It's all just wishful fucking thinking, isn't it?
Right.
Lockdown number 2678, but we are ploughing on.
Hey, we're nearly at our 1 year lockdown anniversary. Can you believe that?
It's absolutely mental, but we should be very thankful because it did let us give birth to this wonderful podcast.
It certainly did. What on earth would we have been doing if it were not for this?
What is on the agenda today?
Well, coming up later, we have our interviews with John and Michael Breslin, who share the insight they have into John Breslin, who was at the march in 1970. And if you want to hear more about John, have a listen to episode 3, where we break that down for you.
It's a good one, so check it out. Then we will be catching up with Lewis Hetherington and David Allen, who joined us from Glasgow to talk about the Coming Back Out Ball and LGBTI plus Elders Dance Social Club, which is a co-production between the National Theatre of Scotland and All the Queen's Men in Melbourne.
Now, like we said earlier, we have been bowled over by the response to the podcast. But we're also really excited to say that it has brought forward people with more information about the march and who might have been there.
This is us back on the 28th of November, the day after we released episode 1 and got a tweet endorsement from Sir Ian McKellen.
Yes!
Did we mention that?
We may have done.
Hello, darling.
Why are you like...
I just pressed the wrong button. I was trying to do a funny voice and it cut out.
Oh, yeah, because you hung up on me. We've had a Twitter message from a man named Terry Stacey.
What about the podcast?
Yeah, MBE.
Ooh!
He's a community campaigner, school governor, and from looking him up, it says he got his MBE for services to housing.
You mean campaigning for housing? So
services to housing, where he lives in the East End of London. And he said that he can put us in touch with a man named Bernard Greaves, who was former president of the Liberal Party, and who was a close friend of Louis Eakes and was at the demonstration.
Fuck. That's cool. See, baby, people are listening.
Don't ever say fuck like that again.
This was big news. I mean, as you know, it's near on impossible to find out any information about Louis Eakes, whose arrest in 1970 was the catalyst for the march by the GLF. So to speak with someone who knew him was going to be a massive step forward for us. And we had another name. Bernard Greaves. Bringing our new total to 26 names.
And so we replied to Terry, asking for an introduction to Bernard, and waited. And we'll bring you up to date with what happened later in this episode.
Now, in episode 4, we shared a short, confused phone call from JD regarding John Breslin.
I thought John Breslin had passed away.
Yeah, he has done.
Why do we have an email from him in our inbox?
As I'm really interested in my stupidity never getting old, I made that my ringtone.
Oh, did you really?
Only for when you call me and nobody else.
Oh, that's lovely.
I'm a doll.
Well, as we explained, but we'll say it again, it was John Breslin's nephew, also called John Breslin, who reached out to us.
Little less confusing.
And he also put us in touch with Michael Breslin, another of John's nephews, and we also spoke to him. But first up, here's John Breslin sharing what he knows.
Comes from a very Orthodox Catholic family, and I think he was quite religious himself. I'm very sorry I didn't meet him, you know, and I could have, because because he was there. He didn't die until 2009, and I lived in London for a time. He was there, but I just didn't do it. But it was a few months ago, someone in the family saw the clip on Twitter. So we all saw it. Everybody thought it was just amazing and somewhat recklessly brave for the time. There was no other actors come out. I mean, Ian McKellen is celebrated for coming out in 86 or 87. You know? So, I mean, it was years before then. The march was 2 weeks later, and I would imagine that they're connected. You know, one of the producers saw that Times article or another article, but probably the Times article, and said, right, let's get this guy. Because of what he said in that interview or in that panel, you know, he was saying, I know church men, I know politicians, and I know this, you know, and he knew them personally. And what I wondered was whether or not that had really affected his career. And I tried to track down, and I did speak to people who knew him, but not anybody who knew him, you know, were good friends. I couldn't get that line that his career was affected. I mean, you may be helpful for me if someone does get in touch. I mean, I've got in touch with people who knew him, worked with him, but no one who, you know, who really knew about his life. And it's a strange thing, the difference in the generations, you know.
Yeah.
Because it was tough for him personally with his family, and he certainly was very much estranged from his siblings. I just, you know, crazy bastard.
Now, John is a journalist and is researching his uncle's life, times, and activism. He would love to hear from anyone who may have information on John, particularly anyone who may have known him back in the day. If you do, you can find us on Twitter or Instagram at 150marchers, and we can connect you.
Up next is Michael Breslin, who shares a little bit more about John.
Forgive me if in the course of this I refer to John as Jack, because that's how we all knew him. So I remember Jack coming to meet the family on occasion, usually Christmas or somebody's birthday or something like that, because he lived in London. And as you can imagine, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, the amount of travel between Glasgow and London was nothing like what it would be today. So for someone to come from London and come up to visit you was actually quite a thing. And I remember Jack coming up and remember him being the most incredibly talented pianist. I don't think I've ever physically been in the same room as someone who could play the piano in the way that he could. He was tremendous. And he was very convivial and everybody loved him. He was, I think, very, very intelligent, maybe the most intelligent of his family. I mean, they were all pretty bright, his brothers and his sister. You just could tell that Jack was on a kind of different plane from everybody else. Even as a child, I remember it. And the way that he interacted with the other children, at, you know, when he visited at Christmas, get everybody involved playing the piano and acting and performing and all the rest of it. But there was a very serious side to him too. That YouTube clip of that television programme, you could see that he was very serious and that he had a real point to make and was very, very good at getting it across.
Did John ever mention his attendance at the march in 1970?
No, I don't recall anything about that at all. There are things that I don't know about this story, but I remember Jack, and I don't remember when this was, but I think it was before 1970, which is when this march was, whispered family conversations that indicated something was very much amiss. And it was between my father and my mother, my aunt, my father's mother, Mary. And as children, these conversations took place supposedly out of earshot, but you know how it is. You tend to pick up in things that they aren't right. And I can't remember if I knew then, but I certainly knew at a slightly later stage that Jack had gone public with something that they were absolutely appalled at. Whether they were appalled at the fact that he'd gone public without telling them, or whether he had gone public simply because of what he made public, namely that he was gay, I just don't know. But there was real anger and resentment at Jack. And I think in 1970, I would have been 18. And my recollection is that this would all have taken place a good few years earlier than that. So it makes me think that he probably came out at maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years before that. And the family got to know for some reason or another. Because by the time I was 18, other things had happened with Jack. And that's why I think I was probably in my early teens when I knew there was something going on. And I don't know whether he told his family before he made it public. He could have done. And I think the children would have been the last to know. And of course, when he did go public, if he had previously told his family, their advice to him might very well have been, say, nothing. So going public could actually have made the relationship issue worse. But I'm only surmising here. I just don't know. But my hunch is that he didn't tell them and that this came out and they heard secondhand from something in the press or whatever. I just don't know.
You mentioned that his family were very angry about his coming out. Did this lead to a complete breakdown in their relationship?
I don't know whether or not there was a complete breakdown in the relationship, but the next thing that I recall was hearing from my family that Jack had been in a very serious car accident between Glasgow and Edinburgh. He had brain damage. He lost brain fluid quite extensively. And the reason this sticks in my mind is because I decided to go and see him in Edinburgh Royal. So at that time, I would have been driving. I would have been 18, possibly 19. My guess is it would be around 1970 or 71. And when I heard that Jack was seriously ill in hospital, I don't know what came to me, but I decided that since I was driving, I would go to Edinburgh and go and visit him in hospital, which I did on a number of occasions. And initially, he was very, very seriously ill, and they weren't sure if he'd make a recovery and be paralysed or whatever. But make a recovery he did, and he was transferred, if my memory serves me correctly, from Edinburgh Royal to a kind of brain injury unit in Killearn, which is not far from Glasgow. And it used to be, I think, an old military hospital during the war, and it was used to help people with serious injuries recover from their injuries. And I vaguely remember going there a couple of times as well to see him. So for a spell, I think I was probably the only member of the family that was in regular touch with him, maybe for a couple of years. But the detail other than the hospital visits, I'm not certain of. Although he may have come to see his mother while she was alive and we didn't know about it. I'm really not certain about that, but certainly contact was infrequent.
Do you think being in the acting profession did have something to do with his decision to come out at such a dangerous time?
There's no doubt that the profession that he was in was one where he could more safely make that choice than he might do in many, many, many other fields. In fact, possibly it's the only one at the time where you could do that. I just think it was the right environment for him to be himself.
Do you know what John, or Jack as you knew him, was doing in the period between 1970 and his death in 2009?
He lived in Brighton for a long number of years, and he lived with someone whose name I do recollect being told, but it's escaped me now. I just don't recollect. But he lived there for a long, long time. There was a tacit understanding that Jack was living as a married couple with someone, a man. You know, it was that kind of, but it just wasn't really discussed too much. But we knew, and I don't know how we knew, because I don't remember the detail of it. But that was a conversation that Jack and I never had. It was just a subject that was off limits. I felt, as a relative youngster, it would be different today. His partner died. I have a funny feeling he was German. I think he died. Jack then moved back to London. And When he died, he was living in a council flat. Not sure I can remember now, but it was near Twickenham in a kind of quite a nice small council estate. And I knew he was working up to within a few years of his very sudden death. So I think for the last number of years of his life, he was alone and living in London. It was only really then at his death that I became directly involved again, because I offered to take his sister, Pat, to London to sort everything out. And it was a very, not unpleasant time, but it was very, very busy. There was an awful lot to do. And his lifestyle, you could tell from where he stayed, was frugal, simple. And oddly enough, his other brother, my Uncle Hugh, that's my cousin John's father, in his later years, he lived a very similar lifestyle, a house with only hard furnishings. And, you know, you went in and you sat down and the whiskey bottle came out and you had a dram with them. But it was all very, there was a simplicity about it that I was quite surprised at the similarity with what we saw in London. Of course, because he was found dead in the street with no ID on him, it took quite a while before the police figured out who he was and where he came from. There was so much to do in a short period of time, because I think he'd been in the mortuary for 10 days or a fortnight before the police notified his sister Pat. And at that point, we then had to, from Glasgow, arrange everything that needed to be arranged, culminating in going to the crematorium at Hounslow. And there were only three people at the cremation that my aunt had organised, one of these sort of lay people who speak at funerals and cremations. And she, the guy was really, really good. I remember that. But my sister, who lives in Wokingham, had come through, and it was Pat and I. And it was actually quite sad that you end up, you know, just with three people there.
Looking back, what do you think now about his decision to come out, considering the public position he was in, and also his decision to attend the march and talk on the panel show like he did?
I just thought it was incredibly brave for the time, because all you're going to get at that time, you know, the world was going to generally be critical, other than maybe a few people, because it really wasn't something that people wanted to publicise too much at that time. It was very much a case of keeping that kind of view under the radar, not least because, you know, you could be prosecuted for certain things. So it's little wonder that people were quiet. So I have to say I was pretty proud of him when I saw that clip. This discussion has made me think that there's still a huge number of holes in what I know. I doubt now that they'll ever be filled.
Michael had spoken about his Uncle John so candidly, we were both extremely moved.
It makes me really sad.
Yeah.
Like, it makes things even more important.
Mm.
Because, like, what happens when we get old, you know?
Mm. When all the other things in your life fall away.
Mm.
And that how quickly that happens. So, you know, this is a guy in 1970 who is at the forefront, you know, he's got a blossoming career, makes that choice for himself and for the good of others. And then you cut forward 40 years and you've got three people at your funeral. But then it also makes you think about that thing of, but what do we do in life as opposed to what do we do in death? So you might say, I don't know, I wonder what he would say about that in terms of, I had three people at my funeral, but look what I did.
Mm.
But then it really makes me angry because I think, I didn't know who he was. You didn't know who he was.
And why don't anybody else that was there know who he was? That's what I don't understand. Like, when we asked other people, they were like, we don't know him. Like, did Bev Jackson know him? We won't know.
Yeah, it feels like he was operating on his own in a way. But the other thing it makes me think is, so Stuart and Andrew and Philip and all of those people, potentially their bond is because they're all still alive and they've been involved with this resurgence of the GLF. So there's something about memory and someone being forced back into your memory because they're present, that, you know, that others haven't. So in John's case, because he's no longer here, or
I know there's a plaque, but like there needs to be more. Like there needs to be like a plaque with names. There needs to be something that like the family that are left behind can still have. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm not the person to decide that. I just think that like he did something so great and it's like, and they don't even really know who he was.
One of the things that's crossed my mind is, was he, you know, was he not a nice person? That you can go on TV and be extremely eloquent, but as we know, it doesn't translate into being what we would call a good person or a person people want to be around.
Mm.
The way that Michael talked about him, it sounds like he was. He was.
Sorry, I didn't mean to feel so sad there. It just, I don't know, it just really...
It is really sad.
And you and I started this, like, we just didn't anticipate so many things. Not only do we have, like, the burden and the weight of our, like, our own lives and our own stories and our own futures, but now... Through choice, we've, like, picked up and began to carry other people's. And, like, that's what life is, I guess.
We're unpicking one moment, a sort of crossroads moment for all of these people, that they all did the same thing. But regardless of, like, if it was, like, a choice, so, like, regardless if it was, you know, Jeffrey Wansell goes there because it's part of his job, John Breslin goes there for whatever reason, from that moment onwards, it's just a spider's web after that, isn't it? Of misfortune or good fortune or... And that's what's really difficult about it. What makes me think it's the idea of karma and the idea of, you know, goodwill out and you get what you deserve and those kind of things. And particularly as storytellers, there's those rules that are in place, aren't there, about payoff and then to unpick it and to go, well, yeah, that guy was there and he was on that TV show and he said those incredibly bold and brave things and intelligent and articulate things. And then he's in a car crash and then he's cut to... And what we also don't know is the richness of his life within those points, because we are getting one side of it, which is from his effectively estranged family members.
Mm-hmm.
Some levity to that would be, what was he doing in London? Who were his friends? Who were? Where was the richness in his life?
Because it clearly wasn't anyone from the GLF, you know?
But if we think about the GLF, though, what keeps coming up is Philip is on about, you know, up to 250 people at those meetings. You know, the GLF in terms of that board, the queering committee were those pivotal individuals. But did John have his own social circle within a pocket within the GLF? We're only speaking to a very specific and the kind of upper echelons of the GLF, these figures that were the drivers of it.
This was something you brought up months ago, like what, without being frank about it, I guess what class John was? Like, and the accent.
He went to RADA, didn't he? And you didn't leave RADA with a regional accent in them days.
In those days, like, was it a certain class that had the privilege to protest? Who were the people who were able to go out and protest? Like, the normal working person didn't have time to fucking protest. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just get on with it and you do it.
Well, Andrew said, didn't he, that the idea that the lumpen proletariat don't normally protest, he said that there was a lot of working class people there.
I'm just glad that we're doing this. Every day, it's like so much more than we ever imagined.
We just want to thank both John and Michael for speaking with us about John, or Jack, as Michael knew him.
As Michael said, John worked up until 2006. His last role was in an episode of Doctors, and then he passed away in 2009.
Now, it wasn't spoken very much about when John Breslin was alive, but the issue has gained more press recently, and that is... how we care for and look after the older members of the LGBTQ plus community. So we thought we'd look into what services and support is available for LGBTQ plus elders in the UK, and this is what we found.
In London, the charity Opening Doors is committed to providing space and creating events for older LGBTQ plus people. Membership's free for the over 50s, and they offer a wide range of services to combat social isolation and promote interaction.
One thing which we can do as a younger generation is help by assisting in intergenerational interaction. This would involve younger people talking with older LGBTQ plus members to learn from and teach each other.
As we found on the Stonewall UK website, being an older LGBTQ plus member isn't easy. From research carried out from the International Longevity Centre, we know our older community members face higher rates of loneliness and ill health.
They also face prejudice and misunderstanding around health and social care, with many, when they enter care homes, retreating back into the closet.
Now, the Stonewall website has some great resources for our older community members, and along with Opening Doors, there is the Older LGBTQ Plus Housing Network. The Diversity Trust provides videos and materials which can be used in care homes to make them more inclusive in England and Wales.
Age UK offers support the length and breadth of the country to LGBTQ plus elders, and the website Meetups is a great way for you to find groups in your local area, whether that be reading, walking, or movie groups in spaces where you can hang out and feel safe and be yourself.
One other project that's helping people interact is the LGBTI plus dance social clubs, run by the National Theatre of Scotland in partnership with All the Queen's Men Melbourne, and it's run by playwright Lewis Hetherington.
So here's us chatting with Lewis and one of the elders of the group, David Allen.
I am Lewis Hetherington. I am a playwright and performance maker based in Glasgow. And that's how I came to work on the Coming Back Out Ball, a hugely exciting project up here in Scotland that I feel unbelievably privileged to be working on. It originated as a project by a company called All the Queen's Men, who are an Australian company based out in Melbourne. And they saw there was a growing trend for older LGBTI plus people, kind of based on research that they were seeing, that there was a growing trend for this community to return to the closet as they got older. That was for a number of reasons, quite often to do with going into aged care facilities. And people felt very nervous being their true self in environments that they felt were institutionalized enough that they didn't imagine they could be out and proud. This research also kind of bore out the fact that increasingly LGBTI plus elders were feeling disconnected from younger members of their community, and I suppose feeling really isolated. And obviously that's heartbreaking when you consider the physical, emotional, intellectual turmoil which our LGBTI plus elders went through so that younger queer people like myself, like ourselves, have the freedoms we have today. You know, they literally put their bodies in physical harm's way so we could have what we have. So the idea of them feeling isolated from the community, returning to the closet is desperately sad and deeply problematic. So anyway, All the Queen's Men decided to do something about it in Melbourne, Australia, and they decided to do this project called the Coming Back Out Ball, which is all about celebrating and amplifying the lives of LGBTI plus elders. The project's been running there for, I think, they're in about year six, and they've had three of these ball events itself. The project is all about engagement and participation and building a network of LGBTI plus elders, but it culminates every year in the Coming Back Out Ball, which is a really spectacular social event celebrating this community. I came to the project because the artistic director of the National Theatre of Scotland, Jackie Wiley, approached me. She said, "Do you want to go to a ball in Melbourne?" I went, "Yes, I do." And so I got to go over and I got to go to the ball in Australia and just see the incredible work that All the Queen's Men were doing out there. And so the National Theatre of Scotland decided that in partnership with All the Queen's Men, that they would debut the Coming Back Out Ball here in Scotland. We also partnered up with Luminate, which is Scotland's creative ageing organisation, also Eden Court up in Inverness, and also Glasgow City Council. I think, again, there can be a misconception that LGBTI plus people are all centred in urban spaces, and of course that isn't the case. So it was really important to us to see this as a national project, and of course our ambition is to kind of connect with all LGBTI plus elders across the whole of Scotland and beyond, if anyone wants to. So it felt really important to have a kind of presence and bases across Scotland. From May last year, we were doing monthly dance clubs where LGBTI plus elders could meet up in a safe space, connect and be creative, learn dance routines. And we've now been doing that online since lockdown. So that's been a fantastic tool. And we're still working towards the Coming Back Out Ball, which would have been June past, but we are working towards doing the ball next summer.
What type of people engage with the ball and the dance groups?
As is often the case, there's a core of people that are really, really regular. There's other people that pop in and out. There's people that have been once or twice. And I think, again, it's another joy of the project that we try to design it so it really, really works for whatever level of engagement you want. We're always looking to grow it. We're always wanting more and more people. Because as I say, like, that's our mission, really. Impossible as it might be, we'd love to sort of be in dialogue with every single LGBTI plus elder in Scotland. We'd love to include all of them in this conversation that we're trying to facilitate and we're trying to galvanise. So we're always looking for ways to sort of reach out and include new people. And I mean, I think one of the most potent ways we've done that is through building trust and connection with dance club members who come regularly. Then actually they share it with their friends, they share it with their trusted networks. And then those people come along and join us from that. I spoke to someone at the ball in Melbourne, and I think he'd known about the dance club element for, I think, a year before he even felt brave enough to go through the door, and then he didn't go to the first ball, and it was waiting till the second ball before he felt confident to do it. It's a long old journey, it's a long old process, and I think it's, in lots of ways, it can be very vulnerable and very exposing. So I think it takes a lot of confidence for people to come along. I mean, and you know, this podcast is brilliant. Well, obviously it's lovely to talk to you guys, it's lovely to talk about the project, but every time I do something like this, I just think, oh, maybe one more person will hear and one more person will come along. And then that makes every single interview and chat like this I do totally worthwhile. Just the thought that, yeah, someone else might hear about the dance club and get involved.
What are the challenges you face in the work?
First of all, I think there's a lack of awareness of this being an issue. And I include myself in that. Like, I didn't fully appreciate the scope of this problem until it was put in front of me. And I feel really aware as a queer young person how ignorant I was of this until, as I say, I really started to dig into it. And I think there's still huge barriers to face in terms of people's broader society and broader institutions understanding things like what it means to be heteronormative and what it means to sort of just assume everyone's straight. Because I think so often the conversation goes along the lines of like, oh, well, we don't have any LGBT plus people in our care home because they haven't told us. And obviously it's that unpackaging of going, well, maybe they haven't told you because they don't feel safe to. And actually you have to do quite a lot of work before LGBT plus people can feel safe, especially elders who, you know, and Scotland now has relatively some of the best legislation in the world, which is fantastic. But actually it's very recent in Scotland's history. And for a long time, we did not have good legislation to protect LGBT plus people. So, you know, when you're dealing with people who are older, they've spent the majority of their lives where their true self was illegal, was taboo, was culturally frowned upon, was considered a mental illness. So I think the work it takes to unpack that is much more than people realize. Actually, it's very unlikely that older LGBTI plus people are going to just feel confident to be out and proud. Of course, that's not universal. There's lots and lots of out and proud older people out there, and that's fantastic, but an awful lot of them don't feel comfortable, especially not in a care home, which even though a lot of them aren't actually, they're not state provision, they're often private, but they're sort of institutionalized enough that they get kind of connected to broader systems of justice and law, which have always have historically not necessarily been on the side of LGBTI plus people. I think another barrier is that a lot of people are coming out a lot later in life. I guess an awful lot of the participants that we deal with and we engage with perhaps closeted themselves, perhaps had relationships they weren't truly happy in, but did it to conform. And perhaps they had children by those relationships. And now they're in a really complicated process where in their 60s or 70s or 80s, they're only just now coming to terms with their true gender identity or their sexual orientation. And that's a huge thing. Obviously, we know. And we all know that coming out is a process we do continually. Every day we make those choices. And it's really hard. So to be grappling with that stuff later in your life, and then when you run the risk of alienating your children that you've potentially had by a previous relationship, your broader family and community who've known you as one way for most of your life. That's quite a kind of person by person barrier. But I suppose bigger barriers would be it's perhaps not considered a priority by aged care facilities at the moment, partly because, as I say, the amount of people I've spoken to and I've gone to a number of conferences, and there's been lots of lovely, well-meaning aged care providers who just don't believe that it's a problem because they just say, well, there isn't any LGBTI plus elders. And I suppose that for me really highlighted the absolute lack of visibility. And that's one of the most significant things I think we're doing in the project, because it's really important to us that it's a project that's about celebration and it's about amplification of the people who are out there and living their lives, and just making sure people know that, of course, this community exists and they have a right to support. And I suppose as well, there's very often a very well-meaning political sort of sweep that just goes, well, we should all accept each other and humans are just humans, so why do we need to make a special exception? Care homes should just be good for everyone. Now, of course, we all know that's really true in a very broad, generic way, but I think part of the challenge is getting people to realise that LGBTI plus elders, not always, but quite often, have specific needs in social, cultural and health setting, and actually those needs need to be addressed.
What impact have you seen on the participants?
It feels like we are on the first steps of a long, long journey. And it's important to say that whilst this project is currently supported by the National Theatre of Scotland, they're supporting it up to the ball. But what we're already doing is going, OK, well, what's the next step? What is the forward planning of this, because actually it's really important to us that we don't sort of have the ball and go, hooray, let's celebrate LGBTI plus elders in Scotland, and then project sort of peters out. But we're really keen to see where we can hand over the sort of the reins, hand over the ownership to the elder community themselves. So I suppose in terms of in the long term, that's what we're interested in, it continuing to sustain, it continuing to be a really resilient and creative community of people. But already, I suppose what's been evident really often on a case-by-case basis is the amount of people who first came along because they thought, oh, it looks like good fun. Because I say, we do these monthly events where it's a dance club, and people thought, great, I'm up for that. I'm up for going on a Sunday afternoon. You get a glass of Prosecco if you want one, or you get a cup of tea. We quite often have a little spread. It's built as something that is just about connectivity. And it's like, come along, you might learn to salsa, or you might learn a Kaylee dance. But what's been really moving is the amount of people who, as time gone on, they've realized the shift it has changed in them. And actually people who have articulated how much the importance of touch is through dance, how much the importance of social contact, feeling totally safe in a space is. And I think I say a lot of people didn't realize how much they needed a space like this. And that's been hugely eye-opening. And then of course, slightly on the spectrum, there's a number of people who still aren't out at all. Maybe that our dance club they come to is the only space where they're out. So I think on a sort of person by person basis, it feels like it's making little differences all the time, which is totally joyful. And then on a bigger scale, we are really keen to try and like join this up with much bigger conversations. We've had a couple of really, really constructive conversations with the Scottish Government. Let us help shape your policy. Let us connect you up with these LGBTI plus elders so you can understand their needs and understand their stories. All this incredible wealth of social history, lived experience that is emerging through our project. How can we then use that to activate real change?
Has your work changed you?
For me, the connection to queer elders has opened me up in a way I didn't expect at all. It's connected me to my history. It's connected me to people who have a lived experience. And actually, it gives me a better understanding of who I am. Quite quickly, you know, we were aware that we were hosting these monthly events and we were sort of going, is this right? Is this what people want? So we set up what we call the Coming Back Out Community Forum. And that's a monthly event where they can come and say, actually, this isn't really working. And actually, maybe that style of music's not right for us. And maybe this location would be better. So there's just this incredible exchange that goes on where we're learning so much from the elders who come along. And I say, that's what makes it feel exciting to me, that it's an exchange. And I think it's also really good just to give thanks. I think that's something I'm thinking about loads. And again, it's something that this project has really given me is a huge new sense of gratitude for all the people who did so much to allow me to live with the freedoms I do have. It's fantastic that some younger people almost can't imagine how hard it was to be queer back in the day. I want to celebrate that and I don't want to bog them down and don't want to sort of just pile on the misery, but I think it is really important to remember how hard things were and how hard those fights were, but to view it through a lens of celebration, which it feels like that's what you're doing, which is fabulous.
Do you see yourself as an activist?
Yes, I do see myself as an activist. I am continually asking what the Venn diagram is. Like, I definitely feel like I'm an artist, and I definitely feel like I'm an activist, amongst other things as well. And I'm kind of continually going, what is in that crossover between those two things? And I suppose sometimes, because this project it's big, my role shifts between sort of facilitating that creative development to building that community. And I suppose maybe the reason that I pause is because I think there is an activist element to this project, but in lots of ways, it's not about me going, this is what I think should happen. Like, I think in loads of ways, it's my job as an artist and a facilitator to create spaces and empower our elders to give them the chance to say what they want to say. Some of them are really politically active and some of them say, yeah, I want to go to that meeting with Christine McKelvey and I'm going to be dead straight and tell what my thoughts are. And then others say, actually, I don't want to do that. I just love the idea of coming along and doing origami or getting better at dancing and making new pals. So I suppose in lots of ways, my job is to go, cool, I want to try and facilitate and create a space where you get from it what you need. And what's really important to me for not just this project, but for the whole world is that we all need to get really good at being networked and being deeply collaborative. So actually another organization who we talk to a lot is LGBT Age, who are part of LGBT Health and Wellbeing, which is a sort of umbrella body here in Scotland doing wonderful work to support LGBT plus peoples. So we're working hand in hand with them, and they've created research. They've created a beautiful film called Return to the Closet. We're also trying to put pressure on organisations like Age Scotland, which is Scotland's national ageing charity, to say, actually, maybe you need to do some of the work here, actually, because again, they've acknowledged, and there was a news report, I think, on Channel 5 News quite recently, where one of their senior management said, yep, we recognise this is a problem. So I think it's about going, actually, help us coordinate. Because there's times when I think we have gone, oh my goodness, we should be doing everything. But actually, ultimately, you know, I'm working for National Theatre Scotland, and I'm an artist. And actually, so what my real skills are in are storytelling and building creativity and building community. And this is why we're going to the Scottish Government. We're going, we need your help. We need the kind of resources you have. Like, you need to be doing some of this. And I guess that's something that also comes, I should say, obviously it comes from having a Scottish Government who at the moment, as I say, are very pro-LGBT plus rights. And they're not getting everything right by any means, but they are open to that conversation. But it's about going in there, actually having the confidence to say, actually, we've done our bit. And I think, I say oftentimes, I see it as my job to connect the right people to these stories. And, you know, on a personal level, there's a story that I always think about. Two women who were a lesbian couple, and when they were put into a care home, there was an assumption that they were just two friends living together. And so they were just put in care homes on separate sides of the city. And they lived separately. They lived out the final years of their life apart from each other and then died apart from each other. And that is just one story, but it's one that's really stuck with me, because I just think that is, it's truly tragic and it's heartbreaking that something like that could happen. But, you know, that's one of many, many stories. And in lots of ways, I think that's my job, to try and share those stories, empower people to tell them. And as I say, find the right doors to knock on to people who have the power and the resources to do something about it.
What do you think makes a good ally?
Anecdotally, the first thing that comes to my mind is, I don't know if you know Categorias Books, the queer bookshop here on the south side. And I mean, I love that place. And it's an incredible, incredible space that's opened up for queer people on the south side of Glasgow. And I don't know if I'm going to remember it correctly, but I think the slogan sort of above their shop says something like, fiercely independent and queer. And then below that, it says, all welcome. And I suppose there's something for me about spaces that are defiantly proud of what they are and who they're serving, but are also permeable and also welcome. And actually, we say that at our dance club. Actually, it's open to anyone who is interested in supporting and celebrating LGBTI plus elders. And it's complicated, because it's really important to us that primarily the focus of this project is lifting up and empowering elders. But actually, anyone who wants to come along and be part of that can and should. And, you know, for example, there's one of our elders, her daughter regularly comes along, because that's so important to her, because it's this amazing space where they can be together and share community together and enjoy themselves. But good allyship, I suppose, is about, I guess, recognizing the need to step back. And as I say, even if you're attending that event, go, actually, I'm here as an ally, and it's actually, I'm not being pushed front and center here. I'm here to amplify and celebrate others. I think good allyship is proactive. And I suppose in terms of our project, it's about trying to talk to care providers, because an awful lot of people say, gosh, well, I'm in no way homophobic or queerphobic or transphobic. But actually, if you're not proactively creating space for people to be themselves, then you're not necessarily being a good ally. You actually have to really go the distance. And I think what is very complicated is that's not about pressuring anyone to reveal details they don't want to, but it's certainly not about assuming everyone's straight, which I think happens all the time. I think a good ally sort of makes no assumptions. I think a good ally creates space, but never applies pressure for anyone to declare anything. I think a good ally is non-judgmental, is kind, generous and optimistic and patient. But I suppose there's times where a good ally does need to be outspoken. And I sometimes find myself, whether it's real life conversations or whether it's on social media, someone's doing something outlandishly queerphobic. And of course, the queer community really galvanize and bite back. But actually, I think that's the time for allies to step in and go, actually, no, we don't accept this. And actually, we promote safe spaces for LGBT plus people, because we as allies see that that's better for everybody. And I think sometimes the failure of allyship, and I include myself in this, is that obviously we are in a situation where we're seeing deeply unsettling and dangerous populist far-right movement growing across the world. But it feels like, you know, there were certain strides that were made in queer rights, in women's rights, aiming to at least bring some awareness to the sort of racism that exists in white supremacy. But it feels like the far-right movement that we're in the midst of has been a real reaction to that civil rights movement we have. My concern is that sometimes people forget that those rights can all disappear. And that's the conversation I've had a number of times as a queer person with people that I'm really close to, that I love deeply, that absolutely are broadly left-wing people and are broadly kind of, you know, pro-queer rights, for example. But they struggle to believe me when I'm like, but they could just go. These rights could all be taken away. They're so recent that we've been given them. And there's so many people in the world that did not want us to be given them and would whip them away in a heartbeat. And I sometimes think there needs to be a real sort of like eyes just need to be opened about the fact that things can go backwards. Like, and I think sometimes it can be very easy, particularly for straight people, to go, well, look, you've got those rights now. So they're set in stone. And I think it's obviously because for straight people, they do feel that their rights as straight people, whatever other challenges they might face, their rights as straight people generally do feel set in stone. So they sort of equate ours with them, and we go, no, ours are very new, and there's lots of people who'd like to take them away from us. It's much sharper, very, very, in very, very close by in Poland and Russia, but it's, it's on the march here, and actually it's about, we have to keep fighting, we have to be aware of it, and try not to be hopeless, and try not to lose sight of the positive steps that have been taken forward. But yeah, also reflect that it could slip backwards. So I think it's good allyship is vital, because actually so many of us need to be allies for other oppressed communities at the moment. So I suppose as well, a good ally tries to learn maybe from challenging experiences I've had when I feel allies have failed me, and go, well, actually, how have I failed others as an ally? So I guess being reflective as well is probably a very significant and important part of being an ally.
If you were to walk into a room right now and encounter your teenage self, what would you say to them?
I would say, you're doing a lot better than you think you are. This journey you're on doesn't have a clear destination like you're thinking. Like a lot of young people, I think you think there'll be a point where you'll turn and life will become easy and you'll feel like an adult and you'll feel like things make sense. Now that moment won't come, but something much more exciting will happen, which is that you'll realize life is continually a journey, and it's a chance to explore and discover and open your eyes to the kind of incredible complexities and beauty of the world around you. But it's also difficult to accept that at the time, because I say you won't get that moment when you just feel like the penny's dropped and things suddenly become easy. But yeah, stick in there. You really are doing much better than you think. Be kind, be patient, and yeah, love yourself, I guess. I know that's maybe what everyone would say. Hopefully that's what everyone would say at the end of a message like this. But yeah, love yourself and love everybody else.
What do you think your teenage self would say back to you?
He would shift really uncomfortably and also be really freaked out, because he was seeing himself in the future. And he probably looks incredibly old and haggard. But he probably would then cry and... I would maybe hug myself and say thank you.
Hi, I'm David, and I live in Glasgow. I've been in Glasgow now, I think, for about 40 years of my life. Before that, I lived in various parts of the country, in various parts of Europe. I've always identified as queer, I would say, rather than gay. And I've always been on the sort of outsides of society and outside of queer society as well. You know, I've done lots of things over the years, lots of different kinds of work. I'm retired now, which is great fun. I would advocate that everyone retires, you know, much, much better fun than you think it would be. I've had any different life than anyone else. You know, I've been involved with Love the Fabulous relationships, some of which, all of which as I'm probably now alone, have now faltered in various different ways. I used to work on Gay Switchboard when it was around in Strathclyde years ago in the 70s and 80s, and that was very exciting and very good. I've never been much involved with, you know, demonstrations and pride, etc., because when I was first around, when these things were first happening really in Scotland in the 70s or in London, because I sort of dressed a bit different than everyone else, I was very into fashion and couture fashion and stuff. So I tended to stand out. So I attracted a lot of attention. So in the early days, a lot of what people were saying was, look, we are just like everyone else. And therefore, that meant that everyone had to look like everyone else. So therefore, a lot of the people who would have gone on the original march or original walks looked as though they'd just rightly walked out of offices or building sites or anything like that. So me in my sort of chaparelli pink coat and things like that wasn't really wanted, I would say, because I would attract too much attention, either negative attention from people going by or anyone who was doing interviews or covering anything like that for the newspapers would just want to take pictures of me because I was this funny, colourful thing. So I wasn't really much involved in any of the very visual political stuff. I tended to stay in the background, worked in the background, or just was me, you know, because me walking down the street in many ways, you know, what's the thing that someone once said? If you just exist in places you're not supposed to exist, then you are being revolutionary in many ways. You are causing people can see you and other people hopefully can take hope from that. So I've dotted around. I've worked in various jobs. I worked in social care for a long time. I worked at an artist model at the art school for a long time and privately for that. I was a feature writer. I wrote things for magazines and stuff. And now I live in my little garret flat in Glasgow, you know, where I'm entombed. And I've discovered the internet and that you can see people. It's amazing. To more people, I think, over the internet in the last few months than I've talked to in years.
What do people make of your participation in the ball and the dance group?
There were so many things that people, you know, just didn't understand. Because people would say things like, you know, well, why don't all these older gay people who are stuck in the house by themselves, why don't they just go out and meet people? You know, why don't they just do this? Or what are the issues that they're having? And, you know, why don't they have any money? You know, why don't they have this? Or what are the issues that they're having, for example, in care homes and various other things was subsequently talked about? You know, so people really didn't understand why, you know, this was it. And also a lot of people, remember, have this very strange view of queer and gay people in that we're all just having fun all the time and that we're all, you know, these jolly, wonderful people who can just go and have chats with anyone that we wanted and make friends and we're all going to be the best friends in the world. So they couldn't understand why these elderly queer people would be alone at home and having difficulty engaging with society.
What difference has the coming back out ball and the dance group made to you?
For me, I had my, what I call my found family, which were, I had a few friends and, but my friends who I'd had for a few years and a couple of new friends, but for me, I had some very difficult times because I had a year where three of my friends all died at this just within a very short period of time. And these were people who I'd known for like 30 years. And then another couple of my friends moved away. They moved to Europe because they knew that, say, Brexit was coming up in a few years. So I was left from that. If you do those diagrams, you know, where, you know, if you do consensual circles and put the people most important to you in the middle, the whole center of my diagram was sort of wiped out in a period of months. So the people that I did then know were on the peripheries of my life. So I didn't really have anyone that I hung about with in Glasgow anymore. All the people that I would go to the cinema with or go out with or go and meet for coffee or just have good times with or, you know, hung about with for 30 years had all disappeared just suddenly. So the ball or the dance club coming along was something that really resonated with me personally because here was something that maybe would fill, help to fill a space in my life, certainly connecting with other people. It actually did something which was very different for me in that it made me actually dance because I do not dance. I do not dance. Plus, I'm riddled with arthritis. So sometimes, you know, I just topple over rather than dance. You know, that's my sort of dance style. So the actual fact of dancing, and it had been so long since I'd actually danced with anyone else, physically danced with someone else. And also it'd been such a long, long time since I'd physically danced and held someone else. You know, I had danced with friends at weddings, bopping about, but I'd never waltzed with anyone's, you know, for a long, long, long time. And all these things that happen, just intermingling with other people and being up close and physical with other people, and as well being in a room with basically a whole set of your tribe, you know, just sort of reinforces your self-worth and your self-being. You know, so all these things, basically, I just started to feel a lot better about daily life. To an extent, it was here we are. We can go. I can go along here and talk about my arthritis with someone else who's got arthritis too. And we can laugh at everyone dancing. Or we can do the Charleston and topple over. You know, so it certainly made a difference to my well-being, I would say. There are a lot of people who I've met through the ball who have certainly, I would say, have become more forthcoming in just being themselves and more comfortable with things. You know, I met someone who I didn't know before the ball. I met someone recently in the street when we could still go out in the street, if you like, you know, in town. And I was in a cafe and he came in to speak with me because he'd seen me on the way past and we were chatting, just chatting in the cafe. And that was really nice. And afterwards, and he said, I would never have gone into a cafe to speak to somebody. You know, it was just, you just didn't do that because remember, people of our age still have this thing in the background of we didn't want to attract attention to ourselves. So two queer guys suddenly speaking in the middle of a cafe, you know, people would in the past have looked, or that would have been obvious. So the very fact that these small things, everyday things now happen, you know, is amazing. So being able to connect with other people has been really, really good. And I think the ball and the dance club has really positively impacted in many people's lives.
How has the pandemic affected your participation in the dance club?
Now we have online dance club. And that is very different from, again, meeting up. That is really a very different experience and in many ways a more interesting and an exciting experience because what I appreciate is that I've been able to connect with people throughout Scotland in a way that I've never really been able to do before and meet people who live very different lives from myself but are living the same continuity of getting older. Usually, in most cases, people who come to dance club are by themselves, living by themselves and have done for a long time. What I get out of it is this sense of collective identity. You know, it's very difficult, certainly in this time, and it's very difficult when you get older and you're on your own. It's very difficult when you get older and you're queer to lose that sense of identity, that sense of being part of a tribe, part of a common goal. So I think with dance club and the idea of the ball coming up is the fact that we have all collectively, the people who have come together, made this new tribe or been aware that we are part of this tribe, our queer history. We are all collectively aware that we are part of that. You know, when I was young, queer people were, you know, camp people on TV or, you know, abused in as many ways as possible. Now, just seeing that there are other people around who are living very, very positive lives. It's just always good. It's always good to see that people are doing well. Yeah, I was chatting with someone after dance club the other day who used to work on the original Spitting Image, you know, which has just come back. They were the sound engineer on the original Spitting Image. And we sort of marked that up as, look, there were queer people working on Spitting Image. Ha, ha, ha. You know, we were everywhere. Ha, ha, ha. And we are still here. Ha, ha, ha. No matter what you did, we are still here.
Did you know about the GLF and the march in 1970?
I knew a lot about social history. Anyway, it's an interest of mine. And I was very aware of what had happened in the States from Stonewall onward. We used to get all the magazines and everything. You know, there was Gay Times, Gay Scots, Pink News, all these sorts of stuff. And I always was very much a supporter of things like that and a supporter of even if someone was selling these items, you know, there would be some news agents in Glasgow or thereabouts or whoever who, you know, you would get to know who were selling things like stocking gay news because W.H. Smith and stuff refused to stock it. You know, the family refused to stock it, and John Menzies refused to stock things like that. They refused to stock gay papers or gay magazines. So if we found a newsagent who was prepared to stock it, then we would get word round, please go in and buy this. There was also the fact that some people would stock, you know, what at that time, I don't know what you call them, male nude magazines, because they certainly weren't porn magazines because they didn't have sex in them. But yes, I mean, I would advocate, I knew precisely what was going on anywhere.
Did you know the actor John Breslin, a fellow Scot, was at the march in 1970?
Was he? All right. Yeah. Oh, well done him. Well done him. Doing that as an actor and being on TV and stuff and things. These were big, big. These were people don't, I think, I'm not saying this as a criticism, but I just think it's really, and I think it's wonderful that younger people don't understand what it was like, you know, what steps it was like, you know, and doing something. It was like living to an extent under occupation of a foreign power, you know. It was like living under, you know, as though you had just been conquered and every move and everything you made was under scrutiny and you had no backup whatsoever, literally no backup. So someone like that, who was an actor, who was on television putting himself forward in that, is someone who is really to be celebrated.
Would you consider yourself an activist?
When Scottish Parliament revoked Clause 28, Brian Souter, you know Brian Souter?
No.
You don't know? Oh my God, you don't know Brian Souter? Oh, for God's sake. Brian Souter and his sister set up all the buses in Scotland. And he's some sort of evangelist, a very religious right-wing person. And he paid for this campaign to basically not repeal Clause 28. He is a big thing in Scottish queer history, you know, about this is what we were fighting against, you know, these. So he's a big figure because he was a big hate figure, as hated as Thatcher in the queer community. And he paid for all these court cases. But there was all these billboards everywhere, you know, about, you know, paid for by Souter, you know, about keep Clause 28 is keeping our children safe. And there was all this thing at the time about should we be going on the buses? Because he owns all the buses, what have we to do about the buses? And it was like everyone was boycotting the buses. But then, of course, in rural areas, this was really, really difficult about what you do about the buses. So there was this thing where you were allowed to have the buses, but you had to commit some form of anarchy while you were there. So people were taking little tins of paint that you use for like Airfix models. You would take those on the bus with you and pour them over the seats, you know, so that you could get to your work. And then it meant that Souter then had to pay for a new seat. Just at the end of the road here, there used to be a big billboard when Brian Souter paid for all the, you know, the billboards. And I was in my office and I was saying to the team in the office, just to let you know, I'm going to commit a crime, but I need someone to come and hold the ladder. And I got a ladder and I got a big tin of red paint and I threw it over this billboard as one of my assistants held the ladder. And all the cars going by tooted their horn. And then I waited for the police to come and arrest me, but nobody bothered. I was really disappointed that my moment of protest had gone unnoticed. He lives in Perth, in a big house on the estate near Perth. And every year I send him a Christmas card just to remind him that we won.
What would you tell your teenage self?
Save all your money, learn a foreign language and run. I think that's what I would say to every 18-year-old queer person.
What do you think of our pursuit to find the 150 marchers?
I think anything that records our history is really good. It's important to have social history. It's important to have that history there. I think also it is really good to show the contribution that people have made in the past just to the way that the world works. And I think it's very good for people in the future to know what is possible, you know, because we don't know what times are coming, we don't know what hard times are coming, and to know that if you are faced with adversity, you know, then things can be overcome. And also the fact that you can have great fun. You know, the past wasn't all bleak, it was fantastic. You know, we can talk about the bleak times and all the awful times, but my God, the fantastic times we had. The great, great, great time. So I think it's great. I think just recording all this history, recording all this social history, whatever comes out of the end of it is fantastic. And the whole idea, even 20 years ago, had we been having these conversations, you know, it would be somehow have been in the press and they'd be outraged by it. You know, oh my God, there's a load of poofs all talking to one another freely, you know, dirtying up the internet. Or the interweb, as my mum used to call it.
What advice would you have for anyone listening who would like to participate in the club or something similar, but for whatever reason, don't know if they should.
The smallest of step is a very, very important step. Making that initial step can be really difficult. It can be really, really, really hard. I think what you have to rely on is the fact that you can take tentative steps. You don't have to suddenly, you know, burst out literally of a closet. You don't have to sort of run down the road screaming and shouting, saying, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. You can make contact with people. You can make contact with one person and just chat with them initially and then take the step from there. And that can be any organization. You know, it doesn't have to be just dance club. It can be any organization. If you make that initial contact, if you know that you are in control, and the important part of it is the control part of it. So if you can do it, you can do it step by step by step by step at your own pace. And then you can also retreat and retreat and retreat at your own pace if you wish to. And certainly working with dance club and stuff, being involved with them, I've seen how they have supported people through that process. Literally physically, you know, there were people who literally physically didn't want to dance because found it too embarrassing. But also I think the way that it supported people in making contact with them and attempting to make contact with people who are very marginalized. There are people who come along to dance club who leave their cameras off. We can't see them. They are there. There are people who come to dance club who just sit and watch. I'm involved with an online gay men's book group, which I facilitate. And there's occasionally people who come and just sit because they just want to be with other people, even if it is in a virtual room, you know. So I think making that initial contact is really, really good. You're not going to be pushed into anything. You're not going to be forced to do anything, because anyone who forces you to do anything, then you shouldn't be involved in it.
If you do want to get involved in the LGBTI+ dance social and coming back out ball, you can head over to the National Theatre of Scotland website, which is www.nationaltheatrescotland.com. Along the top, there's a tab called Get Involved. Click on that, and then when you scroll down, you'll see the link for the LGBTI+ Dance Social Club.
If you want to talk to someone before booking yourself a ticket, you can always email thecomingbackoutball@nationaltheatrescotland.com. And one of the people who run it will get in touch with you. They'll chat via email or on the phone or on Zoom, whichever you feel more comfortable with.
It can be a big step, but they're happy to talk with you, no matter where you are on your journey. If you think it's a space you need, then it's definitely the space for you.
Little bird tells me that you actually went to one, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Just before Christmas, I managed to wangle some time off work on the Sunday, and it was so much fun. I was in my apartment, dancing to Christmas songs. Obviously, it won't always be Christmas songs when you go, but it was just so amazing. I loved it.
Oh, I wish I'd gone.
You should go to another one. I've seen your moves, Fraser. Don't keep that beast locked up. Set him free.
Easy, tiger, easy.
You know what I mean?
Yep, definitely.
So, to our final update this episode. Remember at the beginning when we talked about Bernard Greaves, the name we were given from the Twitter messages from Terry Stacey, MBE? We emailed Bernard, and a few days later, we got a reply.
Bernard was really pleased to hear from us and very pleased to hear that we're commemorating the march. He said he did know Louis Eakes very well and subsequently worked with him. He also said that Louis' prosecution was one of the main factors that led the following year to him publicly challenging illegal police entrapment operations in public toilets in Cambridge.
Which we're really interested to hear more about.
And he said he was more than happy to talk to us. But Bernard did say that he wasn't present at the march.
So that took our numbers back to 25.
But we're so pleased that Terry reached out to us about Bernard, because we'll be speaking to Bernard in the next few weeks about his friendship with Louis Eakes, so we can get a better insight into the man who, unknowingly it seems, helped kickstart the modern gay rights movement in the UK.
So for this episode,
that's it.
Don't forget to get in touch with us if there's anything you want to share.
Next episode, we'll be sharing our interview with Geoffrey Weeks, the man whose whole life trajectory was changed because of the march in 1970.
And we'll also be catching up with Lord Cashman and talking to him about the paperback release of his book, One of Them, out now in hardback, but will be released as paperback on February 18th.
And I cannot wait.
for that interview with Lord Cashman. Right, time's up. I gotta go and walk the dog.
Let's go!
Let's go!
Oh, that's what you always say.
It's true. See you next time.
Bye. The 150 Marchers was written by Fraser Flintham and J.D. Stewart and edited by Fraser Flintham.
Do you know anyone who attended the march, anything that we've talked about that raises any kind of exciting flags for you, please get in touch with us.
You can find us on Twitter at 150 Marchers. Our DMs are open, so please slide on in.